Welcome to Rise of the Rule Lords Unchained. It is your creative and writer-blocked Rule Lord Pete. And today we are talking about something that a lot of game designers want to break into, which is game design. I know that that's a pretty rhetorical sentence, but my brain is super duper fried right now. Pathfinder 2nd Edition is a pretty easy game to design new monsters for, stat blocks for, to use the existing rule set to create your own setting, characters, and all of that. But it can still seem pretty daunting because it is creating something from what seems like nothing. So we want to try to get a little help for you. And we are doing that today with our guest, which is James from Eldridge Osiris Games. James, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. It's been a very busy first month of setting up a lot of the business and doing marketing tests and all that. We were trying out a new business model for a little bit, and we're going to see how it pays off because speaking broadly, in a sense, anytime you're starting up like a company, it takes a while to see if the current business model is working, and we are very excited to be diversifying beyond just, hey, here's an occasional product. We're getting it onto a release schedule. We're going to try to do some other cool stuff regarding Twitch and YouTube. We got some really great people who have come to partner with us that we haven't publicly quite announced yet. And we're just very, very excited to get it out.
For those of you who don't know, James was part of Deadly D8 team, and this transition to starting your own new company, that means that you're giving Deadly D8 the finger and moving on totally from them, right?
No, I'm actually still with Deadly D8. Eli is a very good friend of mine, and I probably won't leave until I get kicked out of that channel, in full honesty. I will admit it has slowed down my editing rate, where I normally would have a lot more time to like edit videos or shoot certain videos. We're not to say too much about what's going on behind the scenes for Deadly D8, but we're trying out some new video formats. I am working with Victoria on a few secret projects, so we're gonna get the Deadly D8, what I call lovingly the Pierogiverse, out and start to expand it a little bit more. Currently we're focusing on Pride Month and getting all the Pride stuff out, which is great because a lot of us are in the LGBT community who work on the channel, and yeah, it's legit really, really fun.
If you've also been watching James, you also know that he has been coming out with Pathfinder Infinite content, which is the Pathfinder version, the Dungeon Master Guild, like crazy new classes. Seems like just about every week at the rate that you're releasing stuff.
Well, it was a weekly rate of every Monday, let's get a new product out. And then we officially opened the company. And then it was, okay, we can maintain this business structure, but like, let's set up more of a foundation so I'm not, you know, constantly rushing to my computer going, is it Monday now? Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And then completely freaking out, try to do promo and press and all that stuff.
Out of creating all of this infinite content, how did the idea to make a co-op, which is an awesome business model concept, of a game design company come about?
It's actually kind of interesting. So I have been working with a guy named Sean, or better known as Eldritch Dreams Games. He is an absolute friend of mine. I've known him for a few years, and we started partnering on some content because he was getting really, really well done at his layout work, and I was getting better at my writing. And so we said, hey, let's partner up. Like I said, I will give you royalties because I'm still a broke college student at the end of the day. So, I can give you that at least. And we made this partnership, and then I crunched some numbers for both of us because I am a business major as of right now. And so I just got out of my financial classes. And so I crunched some numbers and I said, hey, we both make more of an income if we decided to partner up, because not only do we do that, we can now like form an official LLC. We can start writing stuff off on taxes. I won't insert the number of business model terms I can say here. But we had been friends for a long, long time. This is a co-op model is something I've always wanted to do with the company. Just when I initially pitched this to a few of my other friends, we were all pretty new. I think Pathfinder was on its like first year or maybe creeping up on year two. And this was like prior to Sinclair's Library with some of the people who I was talking with, because those guys ended up working full time on Sinclair's. And so now giving me the chance to run a company the way I want to run it, I said, hey, let's partner up officially. We'll open up the company and then let's bring in somebody who could do Foundry. And we found an amazing two people who can do our Foundry work for us. They had both, done Infinite work content for us. I brought in a few of the other people I luckily had the chance to work with, such as, Marceline Miller, who has, worked on me with Champion Reborn 2, or, Comat, who did the Ironclad class for us, who blew that one out of the water. With that one's by far one of our favorites, as well as the Symbiote class. But we also kind of just started pulling friends that we knew. We ran into somebody who was willing to do layout work for us, and they were doing good jobs with the Witch Handbook. And so we kind of started slowly growing it out. And I think we've now hit the point where, all right, this is the maximum amount of people that I want to officially have in the co-op, because the way that my co-op structure works is that everyone's getting paid the same. No one is going to get paid more. I technically own, in parentheses, in quotation marks, I technically own the company, but I have it fully democratic, where I can't make a single big business decision without having a group vote on it. And it has been to really great success, because there was going to be some business moves I was personally going to make that thankfully was told, okay, I like the energy, but let's move it over here. And that has been a great success for all of us, because we're trying to do an ethical system of payment. And that is very, very difficult given the capitalistic structure that we're in. I won't go on a giant go socialism rant here, but you know, I think the broader point stands that I wanted everyone to be equal. No one is, you know, getting paid more than anyone else. We are taking whatever profit we made for the month. 20% of that goes to our art budget, so we get better art, better layout, better, you know, if we need to hire somebody out to do some writing, we can. And it's been working, and we're really, really excited to see further where it goes.
So when did you really start to get into designing any kind of game stuff, not just Pathfinder 2nd edition stuff?
Pathfinder 1st edition when I was in freshman year of high school. So 2018. I was having some infuriating issues with Pathfinder 1st edition of there being about 8 or 9 years of content at that point, and I was kind of losing my mind. And Starfinder was relatively newer, and I liked where Starfinder was going. I just didn't like some of the bits. So I was just like, oh, what if we had all the races have an ancestral HP to it? You know, I think that's a cool idea. Oh, what if all classes were end up maximizing their HP, so we don't have to roll every level? There's a standard rate of it. And by the time I was done, between having archetypes that you can slot in and out of your class features, it was essentially a very, very meta version of 2nd edition. And then the playtest was announced, and I went, oh, cool, even better, everything I have wanted. And I think literally as soon as I got home from 2018 Gen Con, I cracked open a player's handbook for 5th edition, and I was like, oh my god, there's a lot of modularity between these two. If I can figure out a system for how to port 5e material into 2nd edition, congrats. Now that tiny, what at the time was only a core rulebook and a bestiary, had then suddenly grown into, okay, now I can take the 6-7 years of, I don't even know if it's 6-7 years, a giant amount of years, I think maybe 5, 5th edition material. Oh, I can now put that into 2nd edition, now that repertoire expands. And then I learned, oh, I can do this with 1st edition. And then I will admit, this was year one of me homebrewing, and this was before even the Advanced Player's Guide, my writing was garbage. I mean, it was broken, busted in the game. You want a +6 bonus, circumstance bonus to your attack? Yeah, that seemed mathematically fine in my head. Turns out it wasn't. And it was a lot of failure, but I knew a lot of people who were willing to help me out. And now I've gotten to a point where one of the things I really wanted Eldritch Osiris Games to specialize in was that modularity between systems. And I won't say a secret project we're working on right now, but it involves that modularity of proving you can port between these three very, very similar games. I think it's kind of difficult to argue that 5e and 2e are far out from each other. And probably game philosophy-wise, they are. But when it comes down to the broad stroke ideas, armor class is still a thing. Classes are still a thing. Subclasses are still a thing. I think the difference is the way the two have approached game theory. And I think that's kind of what brought me into this space a lot more, is personally I could fill that niche of the 5e players wanting to transition to 2e without going, hey, I don't want to lose my character. I was like, cool, I can do that. And a lot of the 1E base who are really hesitant about losing their 10 years worth of content, maybe even 20 years if you factor in 3rd and 3.5, a lot of these people I was seeing on Reddit, on Discord, going, we really want 2nd edition, but we don't want to lose out on the content that we already had. And I made it a point to prove that I could do that. And that's where I am today, where I can look at a lot of official 5e material and go, okay, I know how I could do X, Y, and Z with it.
You're right now working as the, what was it, 5e manager for Sinclair's Library?
I was. Okay, so for a small bit of time before we hired somebody, I was the 5e director for Sinclair's Library. I did a moderately okay job with it. It was my first time really writing for 5th edition. I'm pretty proud about how it came out, don't get me wrong. But we ended up going with somebody who was much more talented than me and had actually done the Paizo Abomination Vaults of 5th edition. Now, compare my resume with, hey, I worked for Paizo and I did this whole book by myself. I don't stand up. Let's just be fully honest here. I don't hold a candle to, I did the big thing for Paizo. And yeah, I was more than willing to go, oh, no, feel free to take, I'm not going to fight with anyone, the execs that, you know, clearly made a smart decision in this regard.
You do have experience with 5e and Pathfinder and crossing the two streams.
Oh yeah. For a long time, that was a big thing I focused on, was figuring out a formulaic system, and 99% of the time it works. Now I can look at a 5e stat block from, let's say, Kobold Press, or I don't know, a lot of 5e publishers, to be fully honest. MGM, maybe, whatever Matt Colville runs. I could probably look at a 5e stat block and go, okay, this is how I can port this into 2nd edition, and it'll be balanced on both ends. And so I am working on a project that kind of tests my own limits. I haven't made a public announcement about it yet. I won't say here, but somebody has hired me and a very good friend of mine out to port their 2nd edition content into 5th edition. And now I'm learning a lot more about the 5e game philosophy. Whether or not my opinions on the said matter really matters in this case, because, you know, a gig is a gig is a gig is a gig.
What would you say then is the game philosophy behind when people are designing a 5e monster specifically?
So I think 5e is in this weird realm right now, and I think from what I've seen, the fan base is personally divided on this all, and it is between these two camps of people who want 5e to stay the same and people who want 5e to get a little bit more crunchy. So what 5e is doing right now, and with Monsters of the Multiverse, they tried changing a little bit of it. It wasn't, I would say, a giant success, and I think it moved a lot of people to 2nd edition because of the very, very minor changes to already existing stat blocks here. But I think 5e's current monster design is, what are the bare essentials that this monster needs, and what are one or two cool things that we can throw on it? Meanwhile, in 2nd edition, it is, what can this monster do, and let's work from there. And I think one is a very top-down and one is a very bottom-up. And I think that's kind of where the two differ. I think 5e looks at a creature and goes, oh, we see dragon. What does dragon need? It needs a tail, a claw, a breath weapon. That's really it. And then Paizo in second edition goes, all right, what is a dragon? A dragon has, red dragon can, you know, it's going to need a heat aura. You know, we need to replicate some fire abilities. Oh, let's give it spell casting. We want, okay, we definitely want a breath weapon. What are some other cool things that we throw on this thing? And that's kind of where it goes from there. Cause you have the three action economy where I can throw 30 abilities on a single stat block, but they're also limited to that three actions. And so right. I think that's the difference between the two. 5e is a very broad stroke. Okay, this is what a beholder is going to do. It's just going to shoot rays. That's all it really needs to do. And Pathfinder is, what is this monster? And I think that's kind of where the two designs differ.
So there's perhaps some people who want to bring in Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition, or, you know, maybe earlier editions, into Pathfinder 2nd edition. So let's help them out a little bit by going over the design philosophy. And why don't we go ahead and use that example that you just used of a beholder, which is a property that Wizards of the Coast specifically owns, and we will never see an official Paizo release for a beholder ever. So it's 100% on the fans to be able to make it. So from a 2E design perspective, what is the first thing that you're thinking of when you're trying to come up with a Pathfinder 2nd edition?
The first thing I immediately want to do is look at the challenge rating that 5E typically has it as. So looking at the stat block for Beholder right now, I'm pretty sure I'm on the right website for it. If not, isn't that kind of not great? But it's a 13th level monster. So instantly that it registers in my head, okay, this is going to be the level that I need the monster to be at. Because 2E, we don't have CR anymore. That was abolished. Now we're in the level system, which helps a lot because now we can have a little bit more modular encounter builds where I could have a low-level minion and then a high-level brute, and it'd still be a moderate encounter. Meanwhile, in 5e has that bounded accuracy stuff. So seeing the encounter balance is a little different in that case. But the first thing I always do is check CR. And that is like my starting point of, okay, if I need to know if this thing is particularly broken, here's the level of monster I need to generally look at. And so it's playing with that. And it's worked 90% of the time.
Well, that's good.
Sometimes the math ends up being like, here's a 30 armor class at level 5. I'm just like, okay, that seems a little excessive. I can tune this back a little bit more. Because the Game Master's Guide has a specific, here's how to build monster rules. And that is like the perfect guide to monster creation. And normally I will send out my monsters to my good friend Sean because he's like the best in the industry, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And I will fully admit that. I'm sorry, Paizo. But yeah, when I look at a beholder's stat block, the first thing I'm going to clock in is what can it really do? Like, what is it trying to do? And what is the level that we're playing with here?
So we're also incorporating the game mastery guide for 2nd edition. So we don't have to reinvent the wheel. Mm-hmm. So we don't have to go necessarily into the module or into the nitty gritty of like exact numbers. But after we have the level, what's the next thing that you're looking at on the 5e stat block to move over somehow into the Pathfinder 2e step?
I look at the actions. So the main thing I'm noticing in the action stat block is bite and eye raise. So there are a couple ways I could approach eye raise, because that's the main appeal of the stat block, right? Because every beholder needs to be essentially the blaster caster of 5th edition. So I'm noticing that there's 10 different rays. They each have a DC and something they can do. I think that's pretty cool. And one thing I notice is, according to the stat block, the beholder shoots three of the following eye rays at random, reroll duplicates, choosing one to three targets it can see within 120 feet of it. Well, that's pretty cool, right? Everyone likes that.
Sure.
But how does that translate to 2nd edition? Well, I see the number 3, and this is, you know, obviously this is coming with the weight of I know what I'm doing here, but I see this and I go, oh, this is a 1-3 action ability where I can shoot one ray, one ray, stride, and then shoot another ray. without having to use all my actions for it. And so, oh, well, each one of these rays is just one action. Like, I can, you know, roll a D10, and then, oh, cool, I got the Fear Ray. Well, Fear Ray has, like, what is demoralized action is essentially what I look at. Emotion, mental, linguistic, not really linguistic anymore, just because we don't need it, but, you know, at least mental and emotion. And so that's kind of what I'm looking at, is what is the main appeal? Why do people want to use this monster? And so clearly it's the 10 different rays it can roll with.
Okay. And so a lot of those words that you talked about when you're looking at the ray move over to Pathfinder 2nd Edition just fine, like 120 feet. You know, we have the same amount of space, three things. So you're looking at this. Are you thinking of making this into a more basic action or a more specialty type monster ability?
I'm thinking this is going to be a little bit more of a specialty, because not a lot of beholders can replicate this ability per se. Now, in 5th edition, you have the Gazers, the Death Kiss, Watcher, probably a few more. Guardian Beholder, I think, is even one in one of the APs. It's, I will fully admit, I have not read every single Death Kiss, sorry. there's a ton of beholders, but I probably wouldn't make this a standard beholder action, the same way that all breath weapons and for dragons are still listed out the same way. But the first thing I'm really noticing, second thing really, is correlations between 5e and 2nd edition. Because a lot of the bare bone structure is the same. You have DCs, you have saving throws, you have an AC. Anything else from there just needs to be a term change and some mathematical adjustments.
So for the DCs, as I've gone over in one of my episodes, I don't know exactly which one. I know I've gone over them at some point. But Pathfinder has a sort of sliding scale of plus 5 or minus 5 for very easy or very hard. Plus 2, minus 2 for easy, hard, and then a standard level-based DC. Now, are you using similar numbers, or are you coming up with your own DC based off of the numbers that are on the 5e step?
I personally use, and this is going to be a little bit where my other fellow freelance designers or industry people will kind of start getting mad at me just a little bit. I'm going to actually use the 5e numbers as the base here, because I have now gotten it down to a mathematical science. But the first thing I'm going to notice is we're playing with level 13. All right, what is the standard DC for level 13? It's 31. All right, well, you know, it's a 16, DC 16 on all of the rays. Clearly, if it's 31 as the standard DC for this level, anyone's going to crit success at this level. And so I start looking, okay, what numbers can we get it close to 31 with? And a lot of things, and I'm going to reveal a little bit of my handy. The first thing I'm going to do is add the challenge rating to the DC of the ability. Well, 16 plus 13 is 29. That's close to 31. Now we're, we're really playing with something. And now there's a few more steps I add. And to continue revealing what I can do, what I do in my free time.
That's your secret sauce.
A little bit of my secret sauce. You know, I'm gonna let y'all in on some exclusive action of 3 years of me fiddling with numbers here. But those are the two things I'm gonna look at. And I will compare that with what is a Black Dragons, I believe it's Black Dragon at level 13, because I've done the Beholder stat block before. What is that DC for spells? Because essentially this is a spell effect, right? There's not really, you know, like, it's like a breath weapon on a dragon. I check, what is the standard DC around these level? Oh, is there a lot of stuff that's 29? Oh, great. I'm not, you know, completely throwing the game out. But if the math ended up being, I don't know how, but, you know, let's just say it was magically DC 40. Well, DC 40 is a level 20 standard DC. That's just wrong. I will fully admit, that's wrong for this level. And so it's a lot of what has been preset, what can I mess with, and does the math hold up? And most of the time, with a little bit of fingers crossed, level plus DC ends up in a good base result. This is not a number I typically go with, but it is a good guiding point to go, okay, this is what the standard should be, and now I can adjust the rest of the numbers on that. Because spell DC is going to tend to be higher than, you know, the armor class. But all the other stuff works the same way. If I'm going to, you know, look at the AC, well, it's 18. 18 plus 13 is, like, a number. This is why I have calculators. 31. All right, that's literally standard BC. Like, I'm not breaking the game with that. That's right on my little handy sheet right there. I don't need to adjust further than that unless I really want him to be, want the beholder to be a little bit more difficult. And I probably would adjust this by a few points, personally, because this guy is clearly going to be a tank, because he's going to need to be able to not get hit a lot. His saving throws are going to be meh, unless it's mental, and I need them to shoot rays. And that's kind of what I would go with in my head, is a lot of what did 5e want this monster? Because 18 armor class in 5e is huge. That is a fairly hard thing to hit, especially if you're kind of on the lower end of the level spectrum here.
Which, to me, I still always have trouble wrapping my head around, like, an 18 for a level 13 creature, or CR 13 level creature. That's difficult.
See, I think, like, I fully get what you made there. Even 3.5 in Pathfinder First Edition had their CR 13 monsters having at least 30-ish, maybe low 20s, higher 20 8 armor class here. I believe, like, I think level 30 CR monsters have an AC 45 or something like that. But that is a game design approach where I actually, to kind of challenge your mindset a little bit, think about it a little bit more like this. 5e has the proficiency without level variant on it. And so, if you're playing a level without variant on it, a proficiency without level, 18 is pretty standard for that kind of monster. I'm pulling up a stat block to do some numbers real quick. What is a level 13 monster, just to kind of prove a point? Adult blue dragon. Great. Something I can fully reference with. So, adult blue dragon, AC 34. That's kind of close to where we wanted it. Is there a button that I can do? Oh, yes, here we go. Proficiency at that level. For those who don't know, I'm using currently a Pathfinder Easy Tool. That is an AC now 21 instead of the 34 we were at before. What is that adjustment? Well, that's 13. That's literally the level of the creature. So 18 and 21, that's what, like, three off of each other? So you're still both, you know, that's kind of the way I approach it is, oh, 5e is just 2e without the level added to the proficiency. And I mean, that's a very, very broad simplification of it. Obviously, you know, like,
okay,
I could go way more in depth with the math here of what happens when you add the 5e proficiency to the stat block. How does that change the numbers? What does that mean mechanically? All that free and fun stuff. But, you know, I can't give away all of my industry secrets or I will be out of a job.
Really brief tangent. You're significantly younger than me. I'm curious, did your teachers have the same moniker of saying that you're not always going to have a calculator in your pocket, because you grew up with cell phones?
I did. They tried pulling that move when I was in middle school, and then the more and more we got access to, like, computers all the time. By the way, for everyone who's listening and can't see my face, I'm 19 years old. I am a sophomore in college. That has gone away now, because it's just like, I have Google at all times, and I have a built-in calculator app on my phone. I think the moniker of, you know, you won't always have a calculator on you is kind of now faded, because now I have access to every encyclopedia or bit of knowledge.
I was kind of curious how that's holding in one up, place. It was definitely a thing that they said.
Oh, yeah, they tried doing that.
In school, and
they tried teaching me cursive at one point, and that lasted for a year before I just specialized in, like, typing skills, and now, you know, it's 65 words per minute or something like that, just because I work from home, at least during the summer, on 2B material. So, you know, you guys can all get good products and, you know, I can get paid.
All right. So back to the subject at hand. On our beholder that we're making, what are you looking at on the 5E stat block that is completely absent from the 2E stat block that we're going to have to add.
Legendary actions. That is something second edition does not have. There is no such thing. Typically, I know there are rare exceptions with the Etin. Typically, four actions don't exist on a monster. Or even actions that happen outside of reactions on another character's turn unless it's a free action. And so, what does that mean? Well, legendary actions are the big specialized thing here. And looking at the Beholder, the Beholder can take three legendary actions, and it can use its legendary action to shoot an IRA. Well, the way I kind of look at it is a case-by-case basis for whether or not a legendary action should be added to a stat block. In this case, I'm not going to add a IRA stat block as part of the thing. But let's say dragons of 5th edition, their wing attack is not built into their stat block. It is a legendary action that they can take. Well, that's weird. I can do wing attacks with my, adult blue dragon. Okay, so that's just one action then. And what's really nice, and this is also a little secret sauce moment here, the legendary action economy says whether or not certain abilities take 1 to 3 of their legendary actions to do. Oh, that's perfect. What do I have in second edition? 1 to 3 actions to play with. And it's real nice when I can just see a stat block and go, this legendary action costs 2 actions to do. I'm like, great. 2 actions on your turn. You can now do whatever the specialized ability is. And this is why I keep trying to tell people is that there are so many correlations that we don't think of until you approach the game from the game designer's perspective. Like being a casual player of second edition, you're going to go, oh, they're really, really different. And then you got me over here going, well, actually, my friend, you take a very 3 years worth of failing into account and then, finally figure out a system of conversion. It's actually way more similar than you thought. And then that formula ends up being translated to actually you could convert this using kind of the same math with first edition or Starfinder, because I've done Starfinder second edition work. It has been absolutely fun doing that. But these games are all still centered around the same base idea. They all have their different design philosophies. I'm not saying everything will port as nicely. A lot of it is adjusting case by case. But I think people really should start seeing that there are major similarities between them. Mm-hmm. It is just about the flavor of play. I'm not saying you have to go play 5th edition. I personally don't play 5th edition outside of being invited to a game. I love me some 2E. I will fully admit that. 3 action economy is my bread and butter now.
But you do understand the 5E philosophy, and that's obviously proven to be a pretty lucrative understanding. Or, lucrative enough. Probably not getting any, sports cars off of
No, me and my Mercedes, man, we're just making that 2E and 5E buck, really just tearing it down. When I say Mercedes, I mean the one from, 1987. that's broken down and, probably is worth $100. The engine is nearly falling out of the car at this point. Yeah. Me and these big buck Paizo designers are all rolling around our cities, absolutely tearing it.
Right. The wealthy elite Pathfinder Paizo staff.
Oh yeah. 100%. We're all this is just something we don't say publicly, but we're all just dripping with gold over here. Once we figured out our gold economy from when second edition was made, we are all just like money troubles. Yeah, right. And
so that's a lot of great advice to go on when we have a baseline to go off of, where you've got your Rime of the Frost Maiden or whatever 5e source book, and you're like, I want to bring this over into 2e, but Let's say you have a particularly aspirational person who wants to come up with their very own unique concept. So let's talk a little bit about design for making player stuff, the ancestry, the background, and the classes, stuff that goes into that and what you're thinking about when you are designing those things from scratch. Because there is no game mastery entry, as far as I'm aware, about how to come up with those things. People are going off of, you know, what they feel is right. You've made a couple. Do you want to talk about what went into designing the couple of products that you've released on Pathfinder Infinite?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I think the main thing is comparison. And I think this is second edition's strongest tool here. Is what isn't done yet, and will the math hold up for this? And that's kind of where a lot of it is down to peer review. So if I was doing a brand new swashbuckler style, right? It's all about crafting. I don't know why, but let's just say I really wanted a crafty kind of swashbuckler. And, you know, I wanted them to gain panache anytime they use a crafting base action. And, you know, like, let's just say they get a meta quick alchemy thing that can give them, panache. It's looking at what already pre-exists. How can I change that a little bit enough to be unique? And where can I add in my own flavor? And so with second edition particularly, and this is why I play 2E way more than I play 5E, is that it's all, I hate to use the word similar, because that is the absolute wrong word. It follows a structure. Okay, that's a better word. Structure. Where all the subclasses are following this same line of progression. And, you know, they're all getting their, like, unique abilities, but, you know, the swashbuckler gets their first thing, their level one thing for panache with their subclass, where it's going to be, you know, based on a skill action, based on a skill, and potentially can get a skill feat to help them gain panache, right? And then they have their level 13 or 11, pretty sure 13, ability where it upgrades that panache. Okay, great. Well, you know what? That's two things, but they're all working relatively similar in the same structure. Obviously a, you know, braggart swashbuckler, somebody who works primarily with demoralizing, is going to work very different from, you know, a battle dancer who uses performance. Like, the implications are very different, you know. One is going to be a lot more, I'm going to reduce the armor class so I can hit really, really hard with my, with my confident finisher. And with, like, Battle Dancer, for instance, it's a lot of mesmerizing the foe. How can I get them to come hit me? You know, a lot of more action manipulation. And so if I'm doing this crafting swashbuckler, what do I really want with it? That, I think that's the main question people ask, because if you follow the same structure of skill, skill action, skill feat, well, now we have a lot of, like, different things we can play with. And if you become more and more of a designer, you can start playing with, oh, what if it's not just skill actions? What if, you know, it's when you do this very particular action and you can just give them a specific action. When they do this particular action, they're going to get panache. And that's kind of what I really like about second edition, is that there is an internal check and balance between all the different subclasses within that section of a class. And so, not to compare it to, like, 5e too often here, but, like, that is not true that often in 5th edition, because they're going on, okay, what sounds cool? And, like, what's relatively mathematically leveled? Most of the time, it's a hit or miss whether or not it's, you know, mathematically sound. But they have bounded accuracy. We have accuracy. There's two different things here. But, like, a barbarian at first level. Sorry, a third level, because I don't even get their subclasses at first level. I forget that at times. Their primal instinct, primal, whatever, their subclass thing. Like, Bear Totem gives them resistance to all damage except psychic, compared to, like, Storm barbarians who get, like, an aura, Like, that deals 2 to 3 points of damage. I'm just like, what is objectively stronger than the other? And they're both getting them at the same level. And that's why the 5e, you know, power game creep design comes up with just like, well, if I took 3 levels in Barbarian over here, and then I took a few more in Rogue, I can, like, get Reckless Attack at you, get Sneak Advantage on all that, and then, you know, on top of all that, I will have resistance to any damage that comes at me. And if I'm playing a Kel'Thasar, I now have resistance to everything while I'm raging. But I can only rage 2-3 times in a day. I'm just like, at that point, I'm just like, well, I got this cool dandy archetype over here where, you know, I could upstage people because I'm cool. And, you know, it's not so much of power gaming, but it's just more of like, what is the craziest concept I can throw to a character? Cool. A gambling drunken monk who is a teddy bear whose entire thing is feint actions and, you know, reducing the armor class so he can flurry blows. And I think that's just kind of, when approaching it from a creator's perspective, it's a lot of what hasn't been done, what can be done, and what is appropriate for the level. And a lot of it is comparing it to other abilities, you know. It definitely is a lot of understanding game philosophy, which took me a while. Sure. And I will fully admit it took me a while to get. But I think Tui has probably the best community I've ever seen for homebrew material. I know 5e has a giant base for, you know, getting your stuff peer reviewed, but I could throw anything I really want onto, let's just say, the Deli D8 server, Nonat server, or, you know, any Tui server that has anyone who can really write games on there. They can peer review and go, oh, this seems a little broken because this fee at 6th level can ascend, is going to do the same thing as your 2nd level ability. Maybe either change 1 or 2 things here or post it on Reddit, where I know there's a good chance if you post like Pathfinder 2E or the Pathfinder Creations subreddits, you're going to get a lot of hits or views on it, you know? And times when I get tagged on Twitter just going, hey, does this seem like, you know, fairly balanced, you know, James, what's your thoughts on this? And, you know, because I don't get off Twitter ever, good chances I'm going to see it. I'm going to go, oh, okay, well, you know, this thing right here could get tweaked, or I could just go, oh, that's really, really cool. I really like that idea. And then just go from there.
What kind of tools are you using on your side when you're building your stuff? Not so much talking about, like, you know, the game master guide, but do you have any online applications or note-taking things? What are you using that help you when you're designing these things?
So a few things that I personally found helpful. One is having the stat blocks out at all times for DCs. And so what people who are listening to this, and because I know this doesn't go on YouTube, but still, like, my face won't be, I taped to my monitor have DC adjustments, DC per level, treat wounds, a creature stat block, you know, whatever the instant creature numbers from the Game Master's Guide printed out. So anytime I need a reference of a DC, it's immediately right there. It saves you so much time, I promise you, in IRL or even virtual gameplay, because it's right there. But that is always something I have on me at all times. The other two things that I will use, if it's a player-based thing, is going to be PF2 Scribe Tool. I use that as a base because a lot of it can be, one, it has a formatting that I really like using, and two, it has a shareable link where if I just send that link out, anybody can view the little product that I'm making. Now, do I post with, you know, publish a lot of my material to Scribe Tool? Occasionally it will be. I now spent a little bit more of my personal savings into getting Affinity, getting my layout team InDesign. And so we can now make, you know, a little bit more professional standard, but a great jumping off point is going to be Scribe Tool. It's fairly easy to learn. And if you can't even use Scribe Tool, Google Docs, Word, anything that can kind of just show that you wrote something is the greatest start to it all. And then if I'm going on monster side, PF2E Monster Maker Tool is hands down the greatest tool when it came to monster design for me. Because it has a feature where it will, as long as you input the level, it will adjust the recommended DCs to be, you know, appropriate for that level. So I use this all the time, especially when I'm doing 5e to 2e stuff, because that's an internal marker there of going, oh, this is what this thing is. This is going to be an appropriate level. Oh, is, you know, 26 on a level 3 stat block too powerful? Yes, it is. Okay, cool. I can know where the relative levels of it all, and then I can apply templates. It's so helpful if you're a new person coming in, and you know, you're not me who's been writing this game for 3 years now. And oh my god, we're coming up on year 4, aren't we? Jeez, where has time gone? But yeah, it's a lot of this, and it is finding a community that you know, people you could talk to. I'm lucky enough to be connected in this industry where I can, you know, I can hit up some of my friends who are way better than me at this and go, hey, does this look okay? A lot of the times I know if it looks okay, but, you know, always having a fresh set of eyes is the most helpful thing. And this is where I kind of say connections, connection, connections, because, you know, I don't get to do the cool stuff I get to do unless I have a writing team to do it with or a somebody internally to constantly check me. Now, I have Sean. No, I'll keep plugging away at Sean here just because he's like the greatest thing to happen to me for in this industry. And a lot of time it's bugging him while he's at work going, hey, please check this now. I need to make sure this is now. Please, now. I will forget about the stat block if it's not checked right now. And, you know, it'll get checked relatively within an hour or so. Or, you know, if he's free at that moment. It is a lot of love and a lot of trust between, you know, Eldritch Osiris Games and anyone we work with.
So where can people find more of you, more of the stuff that you're working on, and what other projects are you part of that you can talk about that people can keep an eye out for?
Yeah, sure. Well, if you want to see more of my face doing more Pathfinder stuff, check out Deadly D8. It's an animated Pathfinder YouTube channel. We're very good friends over with this podcast. I have personally been listening to this podcast since I think episode 3 or 4. It's been a while. I just know I interact with you a lot on Twitter. Outside of that, Deadly D8, you can check out EldritchOsirisGames.com, where you can find not only our Pathfinder Infinite material, but any material we've published on Drive-Thru, Itch. Pretty sure those are the only other two markets besides Pathfinder Infinite that we've published on. But you can find other material that you wouldn't normally find, such as the Bugbear Ancestry that Sean did one hell of a job with, but also free material. Like, if you just want something like, hey, to kind of like check out like what some cool free stuff is and you'll get a feel for what we do, then you can definitely check that out. We have our Twitter, Eldritch Osiris, at Eldritch Osiris, if you want to get more updates about projects we've worked on. If you want to hear my occasional 2E opinion or, you know, just random Twitter post, at GeekJames513, if you just want to interact with me a little bit more, I absolutely love talking with people, getting so many unique perspectives, unless they're a troll, which then I will block them, but, you know, comes with the job at this point.
Yeah.
But yeah, I am just trying to send out positive energy vibes with my Twitter account. For Pride Month, I've been posting Pathfinder 2E feeds that are Pride-based. For those who don't know, I am gender fluid, pansexual. I am 1,000%, you know, in the LGBT. And it's really, really nice to get to work on all this. As for upcoming projects, I feel like I could give a little nonchalant spoiler, I guess. You know, there's something specifically for people who are listening to this. We are working on our very first big book. I'm currently putting the project scope at 50 pages. Is that realistic? Maybe. But I put Comat in charge of it. I can give a hint that it is going to be nature and animal based, as well as having two or three other big books coming up in the lineup. But we hired out a few people to like come and work with it. And, you know, I won't go into business details of ethically paying them all a reasonable rate and, you know, compare that to an actual budget I have here. But it's going to be impressive. It is going to be very heavy-handed. And I think it's something that 2E has been looking forward to a lot of, but we haven't just gotten to see yet because Paizo is limited to so many editing checks, so many layout checks, writing process. You know, they actually have a schedule that they need to keep up with. I have me, and that is all of the ADHD I can really take. And so we are working on that, and it is going to be very impressive. It is ambitious. It is very different. And I think this is kind of where I really wanted Eldritch Osiris games to go. Is a lot of people do standard, you know, products, I guess, you know, and, you know, Sinclair's Library is, it isn't the, let's just make a cartoon ancestry. That sure. might have to get tweaked up a little bit. You know, we can't really do that, but I have complete freedom, creative freedom over there. And if I get told no, I get to fire them. I won't fire them. but it's a lot of great people. We hired three really, really good freelancers to come on. And when the project gets announced, I'm going to be so very excited. It is a lot of ambitious material, but we know it's ambitious. And I think it's going to be a hit because of just the sheer scope of what I asked for the project to be. And for what I've seen in the updates, every time I go check on it, it blows my mind what these people can do.
Yeah. Ooh, well, that sounds like a cool project. I'll be keeping an eye out for that announcement. Awesome. Well, it's been so great having you on. I hope that any listeners have taken some of your advice to heart, and maybe we'll start seeing a couple more 5e to 2e conversions on Pathfinder Infinite, or just more community made products, which is something that I love to see every time that something new comes out that someone can be proud of. You know, I don't have nearly enough eyeballs and time on this earth to be able to look at all of the stuff, but I'm always overjoyed to see more stuff being created for it. So if you are one of those people who have listened to this episode and it's inspired you to make something, make sure to let us know on Twitter at RuleLord2E. If you want to find more ways to listen, make sure to go to RuleLord2E.com. For ways to support the podcast, more platforms to listen to, and submitting a community use policy agreement, which I will play at the start of sessions. I'm really needing more of those, so make sure that you submit one. But until next session,
and don't let the rules rule you.